Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone. Tom Hartman.
Well, Petraeus is testifying before Congress. The political candidates for president are posturing. Carl Levin seems to be doing a pretty solid job of just trying to keep the whole thing on track, keep it on the rails. But I wanted to get some expert thoughts on this. Gareth Porter is an historian and national security policy analyst. He's the author of the book Perils of Dominance, Imbalance of Power, and the Road to War in Vietnam. In fact, he served as the Saigon Bureau Chief for the Dispatch News Service International, as the co-director of the Indochina Resource Center, and independent analyst with the Interpress Service, and the website FPIF.org. And Gareth, is there another website you want us to know about?
Well, IPS Interpress Service has its own website, ipsnews.net, so that's another place where I'm currently.
Great. And in fact, I found your article at the top of commondreams.org, reprinted from the Interpress Service.
Exactly. That's another site that publishes my stuff.
Right. But Petraeus' testimony to defend false proxy war line. What are you seeing so far this morning from the testimony that backs this up? I have not, so far, now I'm on the air right now. I'm obviously not listening to the testimony at this moment. But so far, I haven't heard much mention of Iran.
What I can tell you is that Petraeus definitely led off with the idea that what the United States is facing in Iraq is so-called special groups of Shiite militiamen who are supposed to be the cat's paws. These are not Petraeus's terms, but in effect that's what he's calling them, cat's paws for Iran in Iraq. In other words, he's making exactly the argument that I said he would be making as a key element of the argument for keeping U.S. troops in Iraq.
And wouldn't that also be the setup argument for an attack against Iran?
Well, it definitely could be used for that purpose, and again, I'm not ruling that out at all. I think the more immediate purpose of this, however, is to bolster the White House's case for keeping U.S. troops there, which I think is their dominant concern at the moment with Petraeus' testimony.
Yeah. John McCain accidentally, or perhaps not this morning, referred to al-Qaeda as a Shiite sect.
He did it again.
Yeah. And then he apparently corrected himself. He said, are they just a Shiite sect, or a Sunni sect, or whatever, But
it's almost a joke now, isn't it?
Yeah, but this idea of these rogue elements. Now, my understanding is that that there are about 90,000 Sunnis that we have been arming and we have been paying not to shoot at us, Sunnis who used to be shooting at us, who are on the edge of revolting against the Shia-led government that through whom our payments have been funneled, that apparently has not been paying the bills, and join at least what might appear to be al-Qaeda in Iraq, that there's some really serious concern here about a Sunni uprising, that we have the Shia, there are competing sects of Shia within Iraq, the Sadr, Badr Brigades, and Sadr, of course, is in Iran right now, that Iran brokered this ceasefire. What is the actual role of Iran? Who are the players? Give us an overview of what's actually setting aside what General Petraeus is saying for the political audience. What's actually going on in Iran right now? In Iraq right now?
Right. Well, I think that the key point here is the two key points. In terms of the Iranian factor, the problem that the United States faces is that Iran is really far more powerful, far more influential than the United States wants to acknowledge. I mean, its argument that the Iranians are backing sort of a small splinter section of the Shiite militia of the Mahdi army of Muqtada al-Sadr is really sort of far underestimating the actual position of Iran in Shiite Iraq.
Well, isn't Iran, in fact, supporting the government of Iraq?
They're supporting the government, but they are so influential with the government that you have the key Shiite party supporting the government traveling to Qom, Iran, You know, after this disastrous Basra operation, I obviously became a cropper, and asking the IRGC, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps commander in Qom, Iran, to help them broker a ceasefire with al-Sadr. And that simply underlines the degree to which it's Iran which is the arbiter of politics in Shiite Iraq, not the United States, even though the United States is, on one hand, backing the pro-government parties and al-Maliki, Prime Minister al-Maliki, and, of course, the security forces, and, on the other hand, actively pursuing Sadr's Mahdi army. Nevertheless, it's Iran that holds the balance in the sense that they are the ones who all of the Shiite factions ultimately have to go to in order to get the blessing for their policies.
And they're also the ones that the Sunni factions fear. So
that's right. And so
couldn't you argue that Iran right now is the major force for stability in the region?
I think that's correct. Iran, despite the fact that they are causing us troubles in Iraq, in the sense that they support the Sadr movement, the Sadrist movement, as well as al-Maliki, and therefore, you know, are supporting all the Shiite factions.
They're covering all their bets.
Nevertheless, their primary interest is indeed to have a stable Shiite government in Iraq. The problem is that they understand that Sadr is far more powerful, far more popular than the government itself, and therefore they can't simply say no to Sadr when he comes to them and says, help give me training and,
right.
and access to arms.
Now this raises a larger regional problem, though, doesn't it? Because you've got Sunni governments in Saudi Arabia, in Jordan, in Kuwait, in a variety of neighboring states that are scared to death of, you know, I mean, traditionally Saddam Hussein was the Sunni bulwark against spreading Shia influence in the region. I mean, all the way down to Qatar and Abu Dhabi and
that's right.
UAE.
Of course, that's a continuing problem in terms of regional politics. Saudi Arabia definitely is intervening in its own way financially and supporting Sunni insurgents, and you know, there's no doubt that's a problem that's going to continue. You know, my point about that, however, would be that if the United States is primarily concerned with trying to calm the waters, both between Sunnis and Shiites within Iraq and in the region between a Shiite Iraq and its Sunni Arab neighbors, then it would not be pursuing a policy of trying to destroy the Mahdi army. It would, in fact, be trying to bring Sadr together with the Sunnis. You know, it's not well known, but Muqtada al-Sadr is the only Shiite leader who has tried to reach out to the Sunnis repeatedly since 2004. His opponents have been violently opposed to the Sunnis, to the point where, you know, as soon as the Shiite government came into power in 2005, there immediately began to arise Shiite death squads. The personnel of those death squads were the Badr Brigade, the pro-Iranian supported Badr Brigade, which the United States was then using against the Sunnis.
Right.
So that's the background of this. And in fact, I think what it tells us is the United States is really not so interested in that, in reconciliation between Sunnis and Shiites, as it is in having a government that will support the U.S. continuation of the U.S. occupation.
Right. It sounds like really what we want is, you know, meet the new boss, same as the old boss. We want an authoritarian government that will simply stamp down instability in that.
I think the key point is we'd rather have a weak government that depends on us than a strong government that will reach out to Sunnis but wants the United States out.
Oh, that's interesting. So how do we balance, and I'm sorry, we only have a half a minute left here, how do we balance Saudi Arabia and the other Sunni states' concern about a Shia Iraq, rather?
Well, I think the way in which that could probably be best done is to have an arrangement with Sadr and the Sunni insurgents who are anti-Al-Qaeda, help them to get together to reach an agreement which is based on withdrawal of U.S. forces and a new government that would be primarily a Sadrist oriented government that is based essentially on a common ground of nationalism rather than a Shiite exclusivism.
But that's the opposite of what Petraeus, McCain, and Bush are talking about right now, is it not?
That's exactly right.
So all the more the tragedy. Gareth Porter, Interpress Service, commondreams.org. You can read his piece, Petraeus' Testimony to Defend False Proxy Warline. Gareth, thanks so much for dropping by today.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Great talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
Speaking the truth that multinational corporations don't want you to know. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
John McCain stumbling around trying to keep track of his Shiites from his Sunnis.
There are numerous threats to security in Iraq and the future of Iraq. Do you still view Al-Qaeda in Iraq as a major threat?
This is Petraeus.
It is still a major threat, though it is certainly not as major a threat as it was, say, 15 months ago.
Certainly not an obscure sect of the Shiites. All over.
Oops!
Or Sunnis, or anybody else.
Well, just toss them all in there, and we'll get them all. It's just fine, yeah. Oh, man. And the troops, our soldiers, are saying, enough already. We've had it. This is Martha Raddatz's report. She's with ABC, and she's talking about
deal from voters this campaign season. We haven't heard much from the men and women stationed in Iraq with
activity, making these endorsements by troops in Iraq all the more striking.
Who do you want for president?
Barack Obama.
And why?
Because I think he has our better interests in mind.
Wants to pull out of Iraq right away.
Yes. So.
You do too.
Well, that would be nice. I'd like to be home. Yes.
Probably Hillary.
And why?
Because I think that her husband did a good job as president.
Only moments before we talked to them, these troops had been listening to Vice President Cheney give a rousing speech, but he didn't change their political preference.
And that's the bottom line. It just didn't work. Sorry, Cheney. Even the troops aren't buying your nonsense anymore. Today's Financial Times. Maliki. Here's the Prime Minister of Iraq, the head of the Iraqi government, saying solving the problem comes in no other way than dissolving the Mahdi army. Now, this is the guy who took on the Mahdi army being the basically Sadr's little private militia of maybe 2 or 3 million people, mostly guys with AK-47s. Maliki took them on in Basra, and he took them on in Baghdad. And John McCain went out and said, oh, look at that, Sadr and the Mahdi army, they sued for peace. They asked for peace. No, not exactly. What happened was Maliki sent a representative to Iran, which is where Sadr's living right now, and the Iranians brokered a peace. So anyhow, Maliki says yesterday, dissolve the Mahdi army. And Baha al-Araji, a senior Sadrist lawmaker, rejects it. So this is a guy who's in the parliament, who is on Sadr's side. Keep in mind, Sadr controls about a third of the votes in the Iraqi parliament. And so then one of his guys says, no, the Mahdi army is not going to be dissolved. And then another senior aide, this again from the Financial Times this morning, another senior Sadr aide told Reuters that the cleric, that would be Sadr, would seek, who is, as I said, in Iran right now studying to become a mullah. This is the guy who controls the largest militia in Iraq. that the cleric would seek rulings from top Shia clerics, including Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani, the most senior religious figure in Iraq, on whether to disband the militia. Now, let's keep in mind that the Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani, Al-Sistani, who is, you know, the main Shiite, Pope is the wrong phrase. You know, the structure, there's not a centralized structure in the Shia world, but there are local heads of the religion. So I'm trying to come up with a Protestant analogy. I can't come up with one. But in any case, so this guy is the head Shia religious figure in Iraq. Keep in mind that he spent most of his life in Iran because he had been banned by Saddam Hussein. So he's now back in Iraq. And the Mahdi army, whether or not it's going to be disbanded, the Sadr says he's going to go ask Ali al-Sistani what to do. And there's going to be, on Saturday, a cross-party meeting of politicians. Excuse me, let me back that up. Last Saturday, a cross-party meeting of politicians signed a petition, a resolution, calling for all the political parties to disband all their militias. Well, that's nice and that's hopeful, but that ain't going to happen. So here we have this horrible situation. The war we won. And this is why it's so insane that John McCain keeps using war rhetoric.
My fellow Americans, major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
And that's true. May 1st, 2003, the war in Iraq was over. We took down their government. We defeated their army. We took possession of their government buildings. We took possession of their industrial and economic infrastructure. We won the war. Then began the occupation. And occupations appropriately end with withdrawal. That's just the reasonable and appropriate thing. Wars are won or lost. We already won the war. Let's declare victory and come home. We're the irritant in the region. Let's bring the Arab League into this thing. Let's let other people in the region participate in sorting this out. Make it work. Without us. Because as long as we're there, we're the interlopers. We're the invaders. We're the guys with the target on our backs. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
6:34 And boy, the piggies are at it again.
Have you seen the bigger piggies in the starched white sheds? You will find the bigger piggies staring at the dead.
Oh, but they always have clean, starched white shirts. Chicago has announced plans to privatize its second largest commercial airport, Midway Airport, through a lease being offered to private investors under a public-private partnership. This, by the way, from World Net Daily, Jerry Corsi writing this. Chicago's decision to be the first city in the United States to privatize a public airport follows the city's decision in 2004 to be the first to privatize a major highway. Back in October of 2004, Chicago took $1.83 billion for a nine-year lease from a Spanish company, Centra Concesiones de Infraestructuras de Transporte.sa, that is a city of Grupo Ferrovial and the Marcari Infrastructure Group, which is an Australian company that portrays itself as one of the largest private developers of toll roads in the world. So let me get this straight. Chicago signs a lease with a Spanish company who takes some of the profit from the toll road, and that Spanish company then passes through the rest of the profit to their stockholders in Australia. And so another giant transfer of cash from the good citizens of Illinois to the good citizens and stockholders of Spain and Australia. Now they're going to do it again with the Midway Airport. The piggies are at work. I'm telling you, they are absolutely at work. And in the meantime, speaking of piggies, time for our Berlusconi alerts. It's been a while since we've had one of these. Yes, that's all Mr. Berlusconi ever cares about is O Sole Mio. See, here's this guy. He was a small-time crook and an entrepreneur. You know, he started out, he bought a radio station, then he bought a TV station, then he bought another radio station, then he bought another TV station, then he bought a newspaper, then he bought another radio station, then he had enough radio stations, he bought a radio network, and then he bought a TV network, and then he bought the other TV network, and then he bought the other radio network, and then he bought some more papers, and pretty soon he owned 95% of all the media in Italy, and then what did he do? He ran for prime minister, and he won! So, Berlusconi, well, finally, after 6, 8 years, however long he was prime minister, the people of Italy figured out the guy's a crook. I mean, he was indicted a couple of times, and he's out of power now. Except, he's back. Indeed. National elections are going to be held April 13th and 14th. That's coming up. That's, you know, this coming weekend. And Berlusconi's injecting himself into the whole thing, the whole deal with Alitalia. Big article about it in the Wall Street Journal. Using this, actually, Berlusconi is taking an anti-free trade position, and he's saying Alitalia should be owned by the Italian government. One of the few times I think I've actually agreed with Silvio Berlusconi. Our Berlusconi alert for the day. So, 866-303-2270, our telephone number, TomHartmann.com, our website, although it's been up and down all morning. Apparently, we're getting some fairly heavy usage over there. If you're trying to get into our live chat room and you can't get in from TomHartmann.com, try TomHartmann.org, and there's a chat room link over on the left-hand side. That'll get you into our live chat room if you want to drop in and say hi. And, of course, there's AirAmerica.com as well. And 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Jeff in Orange County, California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind today?
Morning, Tom. Thanks very much for playing, after commenting on it, playing that excerpt of John McCain. He made himself, after the third attempt at it, technically, going forward, technically not wrong. If you throw all sex in,
right,
technically, I guess he's not going to be wrong.
Right.
Well,
yeah.
But what I actually called in about was the guest that you had on a little while ago, talking about the fact that Saudi Arabia is actually funding the Sunni sects. Well,
They've been doing fundraisers on TV to raise money for the Sunni insurgents who are killing Americans.
Aren't these Sunni sects Al-Qaeda in Iraq?
Yeah.
I mean, this is who they keep on using. You know, you have a book out regarding the communications strategies, I'll say for lack of better terming. It is amazing to me how even the progressive media is kind of falling into their trap, using their own terminology. Back to, you know, the Catholic Church, it was boy buggering rather than pedophilia. The president in this country is a warmonger, or is, you know, is out using harsh interrogation techniques rather than torturing people or being a war criminal. And so on and so forth. So again, you know, this individual saying that they're funding Sunnis and just glossing over the fact that the Saudis are funding somebody. Well, the fact is the massive majority of the funding of these insurgents is coming from Saudi Arabia.
Well, actually, right now, the massive Jeff, your point is well taken. But right now, here's the ultimate irony. Right now, or as of a week ago, over the course of the last week or two, the Iraqi government has stopped passing through these payments to these various Sunni militias that we helped put together. But the major funder of the Sunni militias in Iraq, at least for the last 6 months, to support the so-called surge, has been us.
The escalation?
Yeah. I mean, the major funder of the Sunni forces has been us. It's been our tax dollars. We've been paying these guys $10 per person per week to be member, which is big, which is reasonably good money in Iraq, by the way.
Just like we used to pay warlords to give us terrorists, and that led us to arresting, I think it was a German citizen, and torturing him, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, and a Canadian.
You know, I'd like to ask everybody if they really believe that our military is this inept, that they've made this many mistakes. How is it that Lindsey England was a low-level soldier, and she was, you know, one of these ringleaders along with the other corporal?
No,
this event took place at multiple sites across the globe. I didn't know that a low-level private had sway over the entire hemisphere.
That's right. And it also reflected, by the way, it reflected the techniques that are being used in U.S. prisons right now. The bottom line here is that this goes right to John Yoo, the professor from the University of California at Berkeley, who was the head lawyer advising Alberto Gonzalez when Alberto Gonzalez was George Bush's lawyer, when he was official counsel to the president. John Yoo was the guy who wrote the torture memos, and he wrote another memo that so far the Bush administration has been successful in keeping secret from Congress that appears to suggest that George Bush can declare martial law and take away your and my rights on a whim. Dave in Indiana. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Yes, I wish somebody could always get a word to Brock and have him ask when he's questioning the general, is to say, so McCain, you said to McCain earlier that al-Qaeda is still a threat. Well, I said, well, was Al-Qaeda in Iraq prior to the invasion? And if he says yes, would say were.
Well, my guess is Petraeus would say, I was not, you know, part of that process prior to the invasion. He's a post-invasion guy.
What?
Petraeus.
I just say to let the people know that, prior to there's no, they said Al-Qaeda is a threat. But they were, the only part they were in Iraq was in the northern fly zone, protected by the U.S. government, and it was some general. And I don't know. That's what I was going to ask you. If you remember that one general that came forward and said that there were several occasions prior to them attacking that they said, "Hey, we see these top Al Qaeda leaders, one or two of them, and I could take them out." And President Bush kept saying no. Do you remember that?
I do. I don't have the details at the tip of my fingers though. But Dave, your point is well taken, and I doubt that they would be asking Petraeus that question. But we'll see what happens. Sean in Massachusetts, hey Sean, what's up?
Hi, how you doing? The point that I wanted to bring up is that when you get down to it, al-Sadr is the person that we should be supporting in Iraq if we want to minimize is Iranian input, because al-Sadr is actually an Iraqi nationalist, and according to the statements he's put out, wants to keep Iraq in one piece.
Yeah.
Whereas al-Maliki, who's supported by the Badr Brigade was actually trained by the Iranian Republican Guards.
No, the Badr Brigade is the private militia of Sadr. It's a Shia
militia. Sadr's. I work third shift, so I'm a little bit tired right now.
Unless I've got this really wrong, and I don't think I do.
Right.
The Badr Brigade is Sadr's militia. And the army. The problem, the army is also Shia, and that's under Maliki.
The Badr Brigade is actually, I can't think of. I'm just completely missing the name of Sadr's militia right now, but it's not the Badr Brigade.
Hmm.
The Badr Brigade is actually the one that's backing al-Maliki and controls the military. And the Badr Brigade was founded and trained in Iran while Saddam Hussein was in power. It's on the tip of my tongue.
There seems to be some daylight between you and me on this, and we'll figure it out over the next 2.5 minutes or so. Stick around. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program.
listening to Tom Hartmann, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
Okay, so I screwed this up as badly as John McCain. What can I say? It's the Mahdi Army that I was thinking of, which is working, which is Sadr's army. And Badr, because yeah, Badr sounds like Sadr, whatever. But the Badr Brigade is historically, it existed for at least 20 years in Iran during the rule of Saddam Hussein and, you know, is now part of, in large part, aligned with the, it's Shia, aligned with the Shia government of Iraq. And, in fact, Steve in New York City's, hang on just a second, Steve just got put on hold here, I believe has the whole story here. And so this is, let me see if I can put Steve on the air, I can't. So this is the situation. And hey, Steve, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Good.
I heard you correct the Badr-Sadr stuff.
Yeah.
Very good.
My error, and I apologize.
You're very good about that, and that's one of the reasons I love to listen to you. One other thing I wanted to say that I think gets lost in the fray is the fact not just the Sunni Shia dichotomy, but the fact that Iran is Persian; they're not Arab, and I think that's something that's lost in a lot of Americans. And there's a real distinct and rather acrimonious history between the Persians and the Arabs.
Oh, and both considers themselves the superior of the other.
Right.
I mean, literally racially superior.
Right, and I think that too often gets lost on simpletons like John McCain. Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
Well, you understand what I'm saying.
Having just screwed up the Badr Brigade, I'm not in a position to criticize John McCain for at least 5 minutes.
But you know what? The difference between you is that you don't have Joe Lieberman whispering in your ear. You actually look it up.
Yeah.
I think that's something that's important to understand, that the Persian-Arab thing needs to be brought into the mix, too.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Steve. I appreciate the call and the point. Michael in Seattle. Hey, Michael, you wanted to get in on this, too?
Yeah, I did actually. You made the correction that I initiated in my call. But what I wanted to talk about was the John Yoo memo. This is yet again another precedence, a long line of many by this administration, where we are just dismantling the Constitution, ignoring international law, and the Congress has done nothing about this yet again, and I'm concerned.
Well, they have issued subpoenas. The subpoenas have been ignored. Then Congress issued a contempt of Congress citation, and guess who has to enforce the contempt of Congress citation?
The Justice Department.
Right, and who does the Justice Department work for?
The administration.
The president. It's part of the executive branch, and that's where the problem is right now. And Congress, unless they want to have the sergeant-at-arms of the House of Representatives or the Senate get on a plane and fly down to Texas, and it's frankly, I think it's doubtful that Texas would extradite Harriet Myers or Karl Rove to bring them back to testify, you know, before Congress. They do have a jail in the basement of the U.S. Capitol building, cell.
But my concern is, that being said, or is Congress just going to throw up their hands and say, oh, we can't do anything about this? I mean, obviously there's lots of important business that needs to be dealt with. We have issue upon issue upon issue.
Well, they've done everything they have the legal authority to do. Now they have to sue the Department of Justice to enforce the law, and that is probably going to go to the Supreme Court. I mean, I think that, frankly, they should be doing more in the court of public opinion. I would like to see, you know, members of Congress out there, just like they were when they tried to impeach Bill Clinton, every single day going in front of the camera saying, I'm horrified by this behavior, that kind of thing.
Absolutely, but I don't see that happening. And, you know, that's one aspect in which they could be doing more. I suppose the only shimmer of hope that I see in terms of holding any of these guys accountable is when the new administration takes effect. I would be astounded if John McCain were to get anywhere near the White House by this time next year. But my gosh,
I would not count it out.
Yeah, that's terrifying to think. But my only hope would be that the next administration would be able to, you know, in turn prosecute these guys once they're out of office. I mean, is that our only hope that's left? I mean,
it is, and this is where the terrible precedent was set when Gerry Ford pardoned Richard Nixon, and then George Bush Sr. stopped the investigations into the whole Iran-Contra scandal of the Reagan administration, and pardoned a whole and Reagan on the way out pardoned, you know, Caspar Weinberger and all those guys that were involved with Iran-Contra, and then Bush Sr. pardoned even more of them, and he stopped the investigations, but there were still some investigations ongoing when Bush Sr. left office into Iran-Contra, and Bill Clinton stopped those investigations.
And so
what we have here is a four or five president sequential serial precedent of saying, well, whatever the guy before me did, you know, we're just going to let it pass in the hopes that anything that I do, the people will let that pass. I mean, I think that that's the rationale, frankly. I think every president is afraid that they're going to get their tail caught in the door on the way out, and they don't want to get, you know, stuck, and so they're pardoning their predecessors, and it's a terrible precedent that has to stop. Obviously, Bush is going to pardon as many people as he can on the way out, but Congress, in my opinion, needs to continue the investigations. Michael, I'm just spot on, solidly with you there. Gene in San Francisco, we just have a minute here, Gene, before we've got to wrap up this hour.
Oh, the Bush administration uses words only for their propaganda value, Tom, not for the words actual definitions in the international society based on laws. I'm specifically leading up to the legal definition of the word war.
Versus occupation.
Yeah. Bush administration and Bush backers continue to use the word war in an attempt to add legitimacy to the illegal Iraq invasion and the use of torture and the unending funding that they're
and
getting
the occupation,
from Congress.
And the ongoing occupation. And the Bush administration are not the only ones. The media is doing it. The corporate media all across America, because it's very profitable. Everybody, you know, hyping up a war, having the graphics, having the swoosh noises and everything. Oh, it's a march to war. Is the war going to be won? Is the war going to be lost? And I'm sorry, Gene, we're out of time. It's just, you know, tyranny of the clock here. Coming up next, Regina Herzlinger, a senior fellow with the Manhattan Institute's Center for Medical Progress, is going to tell us why John McCain's, get this seriously, John McCain's medical policies, his health care program is so great. Stick around.
The Tom Hartman Program, taking back the mainstream media, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Program. Welcome to the vast, radical, middle conspiracy. Accept no imitations. Tom Hartman.
So as the debate over Iraq goes on, right now in hearings before the United States Senate, John McCain sort of grabbing the stage, as it were, perhaps inadvertently and perhaps unfortunately, conflating Shia and Sunni. And mixing it all up. But it raises, you know, questions, broadly speaking, about John McCain, a whole variety of John McCain's policies, including his health care policy. This is, you know, so there's some, you know, very interesting discussion on this topic. In particular, you know, what exactly is John McCain proposing as a health care policy, and what would work? What is the conservative worldview on this thing? Regina Herzlinger is a senior fellow with the Manhattan Institute's Center for Medical Progress, manhattan-institute.org. Turning intellect into influence is their website. And Regina, welcome to the program.
So nice to be here.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you're pleased to be here. The Elizabeth Edwards came out a couple days ago and pointed out that at least as far as we know about John McCain's health care program, that under his program, she and John McCain, as people who have been diagnosed with cancer, if they were to change insurance providers, would no longer be able to get coverage for the very cancers that they have confronted. And when McCain was asked about requiring insurance companies to provide coverage to people with pre-existing conditions, he said, and I quote, "That would be mandating what the free enterprise system does," end quote. And he's opposed to that.
Well, Ms. Edwards slightly twisted the situation. If she or John McCain were to move from one employer that offers health insurance to another employer that offers health insurance, their policies would very likely include treatment for cancer. There are virtually no health insurance policies that neglect coverage for that. But if she were to move from being insured to being uninsured, well, then she would be in the same situation as every other uninsured person in the United States, and that is she would be forced to get the best value for the money. So, really, I don't know what she's talking about.
Well, I think what she's saying and what I'm saying and my concern here with this whole idea that the market should be defining this stuff is that health care is so expensive and literally has to do with our ability to survive. I think it falls right smack dab in the middle of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness as outlined in the Declaration of Independence and the general welfare as outlined in the preamble to the Constitution. And therefore, in my opinion, you know, speaking as a good liberal here, the insurer of last resort, and perhaps the insurer of first resort, simply for efficiency purposes, should be the federal government, or at least state governments.
All right. That's
tell me what I'm missing here. I mean, why should any private insurance company be able to do whatever they want simply because that's, as to quote John McCain, you know, to do anything other than that would be mandating what the free enterprise system does, which is socialism, and that's a terrible thing.
Well, one issue is, should we have universal coverage in the United States? In other words, should everybody have to buy a health insurance policy? And if they cannot afford it, should the rest of us chip in for them? I would say yes, so would most people. A different issue is the kind of policy that Edwards and his very bright wife proposed, which is that the whole health insurance system be run by the federal government. That would be a disaster. And the reason it would be a disaster is you would have no choice of value for the money. You would be taxed to provide for a health insurance policy that may not meet your particular needs or may overmeet your needs.
Well, I've discussed this with John Edwards on this program a couple of times, and his policy is, his program is pretty much what Hillary Clinton's program is right now, and Barack Obama's is sort of a watered-down version of it slightly. But ultimately, I suspect either one of them, whoever is the Democratic nominee, is going to end up going back to probably what is John Edwards' program. I think that's the one that has the greatest support among Democrats. And it does not prevent private insurance companies from existing in the marketplace. It simply allows any American to buy into Medicare. Medicare is operated at a 2 or 3% overhead. It's a not-for-profit governmental agency. Its first goal is to actually deliver health care rather than to generate profits for its stockholders, whereas all of the private insurers, their first goal is to generate profits for their stockholders, and their second goal is to deliver health care. And so they operate with overhead running anywhere from 15 to 30%.
And
therefore,
Medicare,
they're less efficient.
It's a great program as long as you are not among the next generation of people who be forced to pay for it. For every $8 spent by Medicare recipients, one is paid by them. $7 are paid by taxes.
Well, that's because the Medicare program right now is only available, by and large, to people who are retired. You're absolutely right. But if every American was able to buy into Medicare, if all Americans were covered by Medicare, that would not be the case. You would have the present generation paying for the present generation.
Perhaps.
I mean, that's how it works in every other industrialized country in the world.
We would see how it would work.
Well, we have two models in the United States. We have socialized medicine, which is called the Veterans Administration, which is where the government actually owns the hospitals and pays the salaries of the doctors. And then we have single-payer health care in the United States, which is called Medicare, which is where the government does not own the hospitals and does not pay the salaries of the doctors. It simply reimburses costs. And
what is the problem with Medicare, and why not expand it to the whole country?
Well, that's my question.
Yes, I'm trying to answer that question.
Okay.
The problem is that how would Medicare control costs? Some people say the way it would control costs is because of its efficiency. But the problem with our healthcare system is that the service system is tremendously inefficient, and it is the bulk of costs in our healthcare and our $2 trillion system. So is the federal government going to make hospitals, doctors, nursing homes more efficient? I don't think so. The only thing that will make them more efficient is if new entrepreneurs come into the system, create better, cheaper ways of delivering healthcare.
But if Medicare is simply paying the bills, they're not telling people how to run their business. They're simply saying, okay, we're paying the bills. Now, whoever can provide this service at the best price, that's where we're going to go. I mean, the contradiction to that right now is part D. No, I agree. Billy Towson and the Republicans screwed up Medicare terribly by saying that it can't negotiate with the drug companies, for example, for pharmaceuticals. They should be in jail for that.
That's the problem with Medicare. The problem with Medicare is it sets prices by procedure. So if you want to deliver a new kind of health care, for example, if you want to have a bundle of care for people who have bad backs or who have diabetes, Medicare won't pay you. It doesn't have a code for it. Furthermore, because Medicare administers prices, it sometimes pays too much and induces all kinds of unnecessary investment, cardiovascular, or it pays too little, like emergency care or burn centers, where there's not enough capacity because Medicare pays too little.
No, I understand that there are some very substantial problems with the system. Don't you think, though, Regina Herzlinger, that if all of us were covered by Medicare then and the system was not operating well or efficiently, that we would be raising so much hell with our elected officials that they would demand that it be fixed?
No, I think that I would rather have the power of the pocketbook.
Have you ever tried to talk to the CEO of a health insurance company?
I beg your pardon?
Have you ever tried to petition the CEO of a health insurance company?
Well, you know, the problem with health insurance is I don't buy it. My employer buys it on my behalf. So the health insurance company is much more responsive to my employer than to me. If you had universal coverage where consumers buy the health insurance, just like they buy their cars, boy, would they be responsive. Look what happened to General Motors and to Ford because they didn't pay attention to their customers.
Right, and I'm suggesting that competitive environment where Medicare is competing with private health insurance companies, Medicare will ultimately beat them, and they will have to be responsive to us. I get it that you're saying that's not the case. People can read all about it over at your website, manhattan-institute.org. Regina Herzlinger, thank you for coming on.
You're welcome.
Good speaking to you. 16 minutes past.
Talk radio for the rest of us. This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
You've got a headache, and I've got some strange disease. Don't worry about it. This pill will set your mind at ease. It's called Pretinatorivox. It's made by Squab Merle Co. It's a life-enhancing miracle, but there are some things you should know.
It may cause agitation, palpitations, excessive salivation, constipation, male lactation, rust-colored urination, hallucinations, bad vibrations, mild electric shock sensations. But it's worth it for the drugs I need. My disease may not be fatal, but I can ease my fears by taking two $12 pills each day for 50 years. They've spent billions to convince me, so now I realize Progenitorivox beats diet and exercise.
Good old Progenitorivox!
At least for now I do.
Welcome back. I mean, isn't it absolutely insane that the congressman from, I believe he was from Louisiana, Billy Towson, gets put into the health care bill, into Part D of Medicare, with nary a peep from the Republicans who controlled the House and Senate, a lot of protests from the Democrats, but nary a peep from the Republicans, that it is against the law for Medicare to negotiate with drug companies to get the lowest prices for their drugs, that they have to pay full retail. Every time a Medicare patient goes to the pharmacy, they have to pay full retail. But Medicare, even though they have millions and millions of people for whom they are paying their prescription drug costs, they cannot negotiate. Now, that's an example of government screwing things up. That's an example of government not being responsive to the people. And I would submit to you that the only reason that Billy Towson was able to get away with that and then retire early from the House of Representatives so that he could take a multi-million-dollar salary as the head of pharma, which is the lobbying group for the big drug industries. The only reason he was able to get away with that is because the people who are on Medicare are a minority in the United States. They are not the majority. It wasn't all of us who were watching this. It wasn't all of us who were going, oh my God, how is that going to affect me? It wasn't all, it was mostly the elderly. And it was, in many cases, the elderly who were totally baffled and confused by it and were not paying attention to what was going on. John McCain, his solution, he says, we can't mandate what the free enterprise system does. In other words, we can't tell health insurance companies, for example, that they have to cover pre-existing conditions. So what's he going to do? Well, he has proposed, and again, quoting John McCain, a special provision including additional trust funds for Medicaid payments. Now, Medicaid are the payments. Medicare is the federal program. Medicaid are the programs that are partially paid for by the federal government, about 50-50, depending on the state. And that money then goes to the states. The states match those funds, and they have their own state programs. And typically they're for children and for low-income children, although sometimes also for low-income adults. And so McCain says, let's put some money into that for people with pre-existing conditions. Well, increasingly in America, who doesn't have a pre-existing condition? I mean, we're going to end up with a system here that is even more broken than the system we have. So then he comes along and he says, okay, well, you know, what we're going to do is we're going to give a $5,000 tax credit to everybody. So you get $5,000 back on your taxes that you pay. You get a $5,000 check from the government if you file an income tax return, even if you didn't pay any income taxes, and you can use that to buy health insurance. But right now, the cost of health insurance, the average cost of health insurance in the United States, is around $12,000 a year. So, you know, this is sort of like the school voucher thing. Oh, well, let's give a school voucher to everybody of $2,000. Well, the average cost of a public education is between $5,000 and $6,000 a year. So even a relatively inexpensive private school is $5,000 a year if you want to send your kid to a private school for you know, the elementary grades and pre-college grades, primary schools. And so what does that $2,000 voucher do? What it does is it subsidizes the very wealthy and the upper middle class. It gives them a subsidy for sending their kids to private schools, which is, by the way, also taking the kids who are the most likely to succeed in private schools because they come from families who have all the advantages. They taking those kids out of the public school system, creating a ghetto in the public school system. McCain wants to do the same thing with our health care system, create a giant ghetto with our health care system, turn Medicaid and Medicare into basically programs that are only for the poor, that only, you know, and because they're dealing largely with poor and very sick populations, the populations that the health insurance companies don't want to take because they're not the profitable populations. The health insurance companies will take, you know, they'll skim the cream off everything else. Then you're going to have, again, you know, 5 years, 10 years down the road, you're going to have the Republicans saying, oh, look at this. This exact same thing they're saying about public schools. Look at this. It's broken. We should do away with it. Rather than from the very beginning, engineering it so that over the long term, it will work. This goes right back to the privatization, the alert we did in the last hour about the selling off, how Chicago is talking about selling off Midway Airport. You privatize the roads? Yeah, sell it to a Spanish company, sell it to an Australian company. Let's sell the airport to a, you know what, Chinese company? Ship all the profits out of the United States. No, we don't need any profits here in the United States. After all, it's, you know, we're selling off our country. We're having a fire sale, right? I'm telling you, 28 years of Reaganomics, almost 30 years of Reaganomics, is turning the United States into a third world country. Now they want to do it with our health care system.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. I still feel 25. Most of the time, I still raise a little cane with the boys. Honky tonks and pretty women, Lord, I'm still right there with them, singing above the crowd and the noise. Sometimes I feel like Jesse James, still trying to make a name. Knowing nothing's gonna change what I am. I was a young troubadour when I wrote it on a song. I'll be an old troubadour when I'm gone.
35 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, speaking of John McCain's health care program, I suppose you could call his program a turkey.
I love your wings. I love your feet.
Our turkey alert here.
You do those things. They're so unique.
Yes, you turkeys.
I love your eyes. The way you walk. I love your voice. The way you squawk.
So anyhow, here's an Ottawa County Sheriff's deputy in Michigan responding to a report of a suspected intruder at a Hudsonville home. Shouted a warning to surrender and then released her canine dog inside. Deputy Sarah Flick tells the Grand Rapids Press, you could hear banging in the walls and the dog growling. 28-year-old Melissa Spomella fled the home Saturday morning when she heard the windows break. So the deputy kicks down the door to the bedroom, and there's the intruder, a turkey. Meanwhile, that was in Michigan. Meanwhile, in Maine, a Maine state trooper tried in vain to break up a fight on the Maine turnpike that was shutting down traffic. Two wild turkeys duking it out on a turkey on ramp in Biddeford, Maine. No word just what the turkeys were fighting over, but it is apparently turkey mating season. So go figure.
You're a chicken. And I'm a turkey. And here is my love song, just to you. I love your wings.
So our turkey alert for the day. 37 minutes past the hour. Yeah, it's, you know, John McCain's healthcare program. I think it's all the same. Alan in Missouri. Hey, Alan, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. How's it going?
Just great.
Two quick points. One, something that hasn't been seen in a long time in government would be congressional oversight if we had a public health type system.
That's my point. If all of us had our butts on the line, you know, literally as well as metaphorically, I mean, you know, if the health care of all of us was being determined by Medicare, then Medicare, I think, would be damn responsive, as they are in every other industrialized country in the world.
Exactly. Another thing too is when you fill out the form for a doctor and everything, you got to put a family history down. So is McCain's deal now gonna slap you because you have a family history of, let's say, cancer, even though you don't have cancer?
Well, there are already insurance companies that are using that as part of their actuarial basis, or sort of, you know, the way that they determine rates. And wait until they start getting into saying, let's just take this Q-tip here and stick it inside your jaw for a minute. We just want to take a look at your DNA and see if maybe you have a genetic predisposition to cancer or heart disease or dementia or, you know, fill in the blank. And then, genetic predisposition, pre-existing condition, same thing. Sorry, you're not covered. I mean, there was a story in the paper a couple days ago about how people are being thrown out of healthcare programs after they've already made claims, after they got sick, after they went and got treatment, after they ran up $250,000 hospital bill, and then the bill comes to the insurance company, and the insurance company says, hey, you didn't tell us you had this condition before when you signed up for the policy, and therefore we're not going to cover you.
Exactly.
I mean, this is a huge trend in the United States right now. And in many cases, it's people didn't realize it was a pre-existing condition, didn't realize they were being asked, didn't realize that the health insurance company had the right to demand that kind of information, et cetera. Alan, thanks for the call. It's so spot on. I mean, this is just an absolute disaster. Sharon in Napa, California. Hey, Sharon, what's up?
Hello, Tom. I have to tell you, I absolutely love your program. I listen to you constantly.
Well, thank you, Sharon.
I wanted to bring up the point you were talking about, the Part D, Medicare coverage, drug coverage.
Right.
I canceled my ARP membership back when all this debating and pushing of this idea was in progress. ARP encouraged their members to be in favor of this plan.
Right. This is AARP, the American Association of Retired Persons. Yeah, a lot of people who are over 50 canceled their AARP membership, myself included, when this happened. And it was because, you know, ultimately, you know, remember Bill McGuire, the insurance executive, the number two insurance company in America, who made $1.78 billion in compensation over the last 10 years? Front page of the Wall Street Journal. That's the insurance company that is providing the insurance that AARP is selling. AARP represents themselves as, you know, hey, we're here to look out for retired people. But in my opinion, the reason that they supported Medicare Part D is because they make most of their money selling insurance, and they're basically, you know, a retail insurance agency. And just like the NRA is basically, you know, a lobbying company for the gun industry. It's like there's a whole bunch of these things that are not what they appear. Sharon, thanks for the call, and thanks for calling them out on it. Stuart in Seattle. Hey, Stuart.
Yeah, as you probably know, what you described earlier with the government working hand in hand with the corporations, dictating that Medicare patients pay private companies their full rate for pharmaceuticals, pay private companies the full rate for health insurance,
yep,
and privatizing our roads so that private companies will collect tolls every time we go over them. It's what Mussolini probably would have called fascism. I think that fits that definition.
Yeah, he did.
Fascism.
He did. Actually, it was Giovanni Gentile who wrote that entry for the Encyclopedia Italiana that, you know, fascism is the merger of state and business interests. But it's attributed to Mussolini, and Mussolini certainly would have agreed with it. You're right. Thank you, Stuart. Sean in Indianapolis. Hey, Sean.
Hey, Tom. Long time no talk.
Yeah. Hey, it's great to hear from you.
Hey, maybe the powers that be have switched from pigeons turkeys, you think?
From pigeons to turkeys, yeah. The new spies, there you go, the new aliens.
Hey, one thing that no one is bringing up is we got such a nursing and doctor and overall staff shortage. Where are we going to get all these people that are going to take care of all these people that are going to have health care insurance all of a sudden?
Yeah, well, maybe we'll get them from Cuba, Sean. I know you as a disabled person who's had several hundred surgeries. And
335.
And yeah, I'm sorry?
335.
335 surgeries. You've really been, you know, through hell and back, and you know, it's good to hear that you're still listening, and after, 5-6 years here, that you've been a regular caller to this program.
Yeah.
Good to know that you're still with us. But you've seen it firsthand, and this is something that the American Medical Association started doing back in the 40s or 50s, was when they got control of how many people could enter and what the standards would be for medical schools. And in the beginning, it seemed like a good idea. You know, yeah, let's give a professional organization control over standards and things like that. But what it has become is a way of rationing the number of doctors in order to keep the pay for physicians high. And the tragedy is that now there are large chunks of the United States. When I lived in Vermont, there are rural communities in Vermont where you can't see, if you want to see a doctor, you have to make an appointment 5-6 months out, and you have to travel 50, 60 miles. I mean, it's an absolute disaster as a consequence of this. And still there are doctors who are not, making a good living in some specialties, and others who are making millions. It is all out of whack. And, when I lived in Germany, the doctor that I had, and you could call and you could generally see them the exact same day, he made a good living. I mean, he was at the top end of the upper middle class. He was doing fine, but he wasn't a multimillionaire, but he was doing fine. And the same thing in England. I mean, what's wrong with just like in Cuba saying, anybody who wants to become a doctor can become a doctor?
Well, another thing that we need to bring up also is, the bed space.
Yeah.
The bed space is constantly, at all the hospitals are constantly filled.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the people that are really getting screwed are the home health aides, as well as the people too. The AIDS, and we're not talking about preventative medicine either.
Yeah.
That's what we really need to do, preventative medicine.
You're absolutely right, Sean. Sean, thank you.
All right.
Thanks a lot for the call. It's great to hear from you. I've got to move along, but it's always good to hear from you, Sean. And I'm glad to know that you're still, alive and kicking and you're still with us here. Joe in San Diego. Hey, Joe.
Hey, Tom. They did away with our radio station, but I still get to listen to you.
It's great. The wonders of the Internet. Hey, so what's up, Joe?
So now we have, in San Diego, we have a guy that's running for mayor that comes from the health industry where he made millions of dollars and wants to privatize privatize much of the city.
Yeah, so well, this is like Bill Frist's daddy. He became one of the 20 richest people in America by buying up public hospitals and turning them to for profit and literally squeezing the blood out of all of us.
They're talking about budget cuts. So at a time when people are not driving as much because of the fuel costs and trying to conserve, they're going to cut hours in the libraries and the swimming public pools are all going to be cut in time. So great times ahead. But I have a personal experience kind of working around the insurance industry in that I bought my own personal insurance. And I know that the agent, who I have not spoken to since 1992, gets 10% of what I pay.
Right, every year.
Every year.
Sure.
There are only 5 companies that provide group health care in the entire state of California. There is no competition.
Wow.
Why?
Yeah, so you have essentially a monopoly.
Yeah. And why aren't the insurance commissioners
doing something about it? Absolutely.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People.
Nine and a half minutes before the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program here on Air America Radio. And Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, on the line with us for our daily update of what's going on in and about the entire world, and especially in Washington, D.C. Hey, Ellen, what's up?
Of course, the Petraeus-Crocker hearings today going on in the Senate. A few of the memorable opening statements is that Petraeus wants a 45-day period in July to consolidate and evaluate the situation after a number of U.S. troops have returned to the post-surge levels. A few of notable statements he said is that the progress made since last spring is fragile and reversible. And then he said It was 15 months ago when Iraq was on the brink of civil war and the decision was made to deploy additional forces as if they're not still on the brink of civil war.
Right.
He went on, which I'll go on into a second. I think some of the more notable comments today was John McCain's comment. I guess it rhymes. He said the U.S. Congress should not choose to lose in Iraq. Petraeus was also asked about the agreement made with the Iraqi government. As you know, a lot of people are worried that that is going to essentially tie up the United States for a number of years into an agreement that has not been passed by Congress because it is not a treaty.
Right.
And he essentially said that it would be an executive agreement. So
Petraeus is saying that the president has the right to negotiate with a foreign government on behalf of the United States and sign something that binds the United States.
And Clark are basically saying that. That's right.
Right. And that is, I think, you know, you look in the legal dictionaries, that's a treaty. So he's saying that the president has the right to execute a treaty when the Constitution says only Congress has the right to approve a treaty and a treaty shall be binding, that's binding upon the United States.
Tom, I think I couldn't have said it better. Exactly.
It's amazing. It's amazing.
It's completely amazing. Then Senator Clinton responded to the idea that it was responsible, that it is irresponsible to withdraw in a planned withdrawal. And she said it would not be irresponsible to not deliver on promises that have been made time and time again. Let's not forget the purpose of the surge, which was to create the space for significant political process. The Iraqi government has not made significant political process. And she said, we don't talk about opportunity costs. We divert resources from a lot that is going on. So she said that, and she also said the situation is tenuous. We've been hearing for the past 5 years to turn a corner. And she said it's time to begin withdrawal, rebuild our military, and get back to Afghanistan. So she clearly made a statement at that point, and she's the one that first asked about the strategic agreements. Also,
good on her.
Yes. And Obama talks this afternoon at 2:30, or he gets the question. And then, of course, John McCain, who is the ranking member of that committee, said that we changed the strategy. We sent additional troops. It's become clear that these efforts are succeeding. The surge worked. Iraqi leaders need to know that we expect them to show leadership and that it is possible to talk about success with hope and optimism. And so that's kind of where he's at.
Nobody is using the language. It seems that everybody is using the language and the metaphors of war and victory and defeat rather than the metaphors of occupation and withdrawal. Are you hearing anybody talking about when you end the occupation?
Withdrawal. I mean, she really did talk about withdrawal. And
good.
Then there was a lot of talk also about how they're going to use the money that they actually have. And what's fascinating, Tom, this is going to get you, it certainly got me, is that the International Monetary Fund projects Iraq's GDP is going to grow 7% in real terms this year, and inflation has been tamed, i.e. Iraq's economy is growing more than the United States of America.
They're in better shape than we are. Oh, man. That is the ultimate irony. I mean,
It is quite astounding. In fact, Iraq also announced its decision to purchase 40 commercial aircraft from the United States at a cost of about $5 billion. So now I guess they're beginning to trade with us.
Yeah, so they're apparently actually using their oil revenue. And when are they going to start rebuilding their own infrastructure? When are they going to start rebuilding?
Well, they did say that they have something like $10 billion now towards infrastructure. $13 billion for reconstruction is going from their budget at this point.
And they're hiring Iraqi companies. I mean, if they want to stop the war, if they want to stop people from freaking out and joining militias and whatnot, all you have to do is give them a job. And if the Iraqis started hiring Iraqi companies and an Iraqi company started hiring Iraqi workers and putting people back to work, I mean, when we disbanded their army, we put through 500,000 people out of work, put people back to work, they're not going to be shooting at somebody. They're going to be, you know, providing for their families.
Exactly. And it was very clear when we were there in June of 2003 that that was going to be the solution. But the United States decided to disband the military instead. The other interesting thing is that, of course, Carl Levin went after this 45 days in a very big way. And he actually asked about whether there was going to be a brief pause, whether there was going to be a pause. And then Petraeus said, sir, I'm not using the word brief nor pause. So this whole 45-day stand-down issue to reevaluate, of course, right before the elections is pretty interesting.
Petraeus has been, you know, floated as a vice presidential candidate, as somebody who may be wanting to run for the United States Senate in 2010. What's the sense there on Capitol Hill?
A lot of people today, actually, it's very interesting that you were saying that, because a lot of the press today were actually talking about he's sounding very political. Is he thinking of running for office? So you're right on target on that.
Yeah. And which then brings into question, you know, what his motives are, what he's saying. The 45-day pause, what's the rationale for that?
To see where we're at after we pull back to post-surge numbers in terms of troops. Now, Harry Reid, just on the last thing here, sent out an announcement saying this has been totally ineffective. We've lost 11 of our troops since Saturday.
Amazing. Amazing. Ellen Radner, tragic, actually. Ellen Radner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Great speaking with you. Coming up next, I want to get into some of the things that are happening with our economy, the Columbia trade deal, and Congressman Joe Sestak. Stick around.
You're in the Democracy Zone.
Democracy
with
Zone.
Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
The smart people get their news.
Well, there's a very interesting piece in today's Financial Times. The political threats to globalization. Gideon Rackman writing about this. Gideon.Rackman@FT.com. His website, or his email address, I'm guessing that FT.com. www.ft.com would get you to it if you want to see it. It's called The Political Threats to Globalization. And as the story is breaking that Hillary Clinton and this is, I don't mean this in any pro or anti-Clinton or Obama context, but just as the story is breaking that Hillary Clinton has fired Mark Penn for taking $300,000 from the Colombian government to promote the U.S.-Colombia free trade deal, it turns out that there's somebody else on her staff who took $800,000 from a company based in Colombia, Gold Service International, to give speeches in Colombia and around throughout Latin America promoting the Colombia free trade deal and similar kinds of free trade pacts. And, in fact, this guy even helped a Canadian company successfully acquire oil fields in Colombia and lent this advisor of Hillary Clinton, the president of Colombia, lent this advisor his private jet so that this guy could travel around Latin America, give these speeches, and donated $31 million to this advisor's private charity. That advisor, of course, Bill Clinton. So, okay, if Mark Penn gets fired for taking $300,000 from Columbia, is Bill Clinton going to get fired for taking $800,000 in direct fees that go into his pocket and $31 million that go into his charitable fund? But it raises, you know, that's the cheap shot irony part, okay? And again, as I've said before, I don't think that this, frankly, in any way disqualifies Hillary Clinton from being a good and strong candidate for president of the United States. It's ironic, but it really raises this larger issue, which is this larger issue of globalization. Keep in mind, the the Boston Tea Party, it's fascinating. The Boston Tea Party happened in the late fall, early winter of 1773. And the early winter, in December of 1773. And when you go back and read the history of it, now keep in mind, the guys who participated in the Boston Tea Party swore an oath of silence for 50 years. And the only one who was left in 1832, the only one who was still alive, as far as he knew, was a guy named George Robert Twelve Tree Hughes, who had been 16 or 17 years old and participated in the Boston Tea Party. And he wrote a book about it, which was privately published by R.R. Bliss in Oswego, New York, in upstate New York. He wrote a diary, basically. He published his diary of the Boston Tea Party. And it was in print for a year or two, and then it went out of print. It's been out of print ever since. And I got a copy of it when I was writing, which book was it? Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. This was about 10 years ago. I was writing this book about the rise of corporate power in the United States. And I found this book at an antique bookstore in San Francisco, and it cost me almost as much as the advance I got for writing the book. But it was amazing, because what George Robert Twelve Tree Hughes described was that in 1773, and I knew from reading Jefferson's diaries and from reading Jefferson's commentary, his booklet on how to be a good British American, you know, basically in the United States, from early 1773, that it was the Boston Tea Party that flipped him over the edge. Prior to the Boston Tea Party, Jefferson was not in favor of our severing our ties with the United Kingdom. After the Boston Tea Party, he was. This was the turning point for many of the founders of this country and framers of the Constitution, and certainly the authors of the Declaration of Independence. The primary author, Thomas Jefferson, and the editors, Ben Franklin and Thomas and John Adams. This was the turning point for them. And what it was globalization. You had tea and alcohol were the drugs of choice in the United States. Tea being the primary one. And there were tea shops all up and down the East Coast. Every block had a tea shop. It was the place where people gathered. It was the place where people were socializing. And they competed based on the tea that they had. And there were hundreds of small companies that were importing tea into the United States. And many of them were considered by the British to be pirates or to be outlaws or to be smugglers because they were importing tea into the United States without paying taxes and without paying permits, although many of them were paying taxes. The vast majority of them were paying taxes. But it was basically a business that was dominated by small business. There were these thousands of little individual tea shops, and there were hundreds of small tea importers. And the British East India Company wanted to monopolize that business. They wanted to wipe out all the small companies and control the tea trade in the United States. And so they went to the British government and they said, give us a tax cut on the taxes to import tea into the United States or into the colonies. And in addition to that, make that tax cut retroactive so we can get what was then 19 million pounds sterling, what in today's dollars, heaven only knows, billions of dollars, in retroactive tax breaks so that we can undersell the competition and we can finally put out of business all these small companies that are a pain in the butt to us. And the British government, the Parliament, most of whom were stockholders, certainly at the House of Lords, they were all stockholders in the East Indian Company. The East Indian Company, keep in mind, in 1601 was brought into existence by Queen Elizabeth I. And all of its shareholders initially were the members of Parliament. So the government of Great Britain said, fine, we'll give you a tax break. That was the Tea Act of 1773. That tax cut for the British East India Company, which would allow them to wipe out the small American entrepreneurs, is the reason why those small American entrepreneurs rose up and went into Boston Harbor and destroyed, in today's dollars, $1 million worth of tea. $1 million act of vandalism, which then led to the Boston Ports Act, where the British government said, until the city of Boston pays back the East India Company $1 million for the tea that they lost, we're going to shut down the port. which then led to the Boston Massacre, which then led directly to the Revolutionary War. So this was a tax cut. This was globalization on steroids. And the colonists were saying no. So anyhow, back to Gideon Rackman. He's writing in today's Financial Times, and he said, the political changes that made globalization possible took place in a remarkably short period of time, from 1978 to 1991. In other words, it was basically under the administrations of Ronald Reagan and George Herbert Walker Bush. He says it started out with China's decision to turn from Maoism to an open market, Deng Xiaoping, in 1978. That was where China started it. Then a year later, 79, Maggie Thatcher comes to power in Britain. She's going to go along with this thing. I mean, after all, it worked for them in 1773, right? Well, actually, it did work for them prior to that. It's also the way that they took India. There was global free trade back then. It was dominated by the British, therefore they liked it. You know, we'd like it to be dominated by us, therefore we'd like it. But actually, it's transnational corporations now are more powerful than individual nations. But so anyhow, Maggie Thatcher gets on board in 1979. And then in 1980, Ronald Reagan, I'm quoting from the Financial Times, then in 1980, Ronald Reagan took power in the U.S. on a platform of deregulation and tax cuts, giving a huge boost to market ideology around the world. So globalization is this very, very recent thing. And the globalists are starting to worry. He points out in Europe, Nicolas Sarkozy, French president, has been arguing for protectionism on a European level. He wants to reestablish community preferences, essentially higher tariffs against goods from outside the European Union. Why? Because they've discovered in Europe the same thing we've discovered here. Without tariffs to protect your domestic markets, everything gets made in China. Mr. Sarkozy does not have many EU allies yet, but the re-election of Silvio Berlusconi in Italy could change that. Hey, I'm starting to like that, you know, curmudgeon-y old billionaire. India's politicians are not rushing to sign a new world trade deal. They're protecting their domestic markets. Did you know in India it's illegal to own more than one retail outlet? 97% of all retail businesses in India, 97% of all retail business, all retail trade in India is done by individual, small, family-owned stores. Why? Because it's the law. They're protecting their local businesses.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
As Ambassador Crocker and General Petraeus are testifying before Congress today, let's get a sense of Congress. Congressman Joe Sestak represents Pennsylvania's 7th Congressional District. He rose to the rank of 3-star admiral in the Navy. He commanded the George Washington Aircraft Battle Carrier Group, consisting of 30 U.S. and allied ships, 15,000 sailors, and close to 100 aircraft. He was also President Clinton's White House Director of Defense Policy and National Security, and holds a Ph.D. in Political Economy and Government from Harvard University. Quite a bio, sir.
Thanks. I'm really just a ship driver.
Okay, there you go. Well, you know, what's your take, Congressman, on the testimony that you've heard this morning before the United States Senate?
Well, I've only caught snippets of it, but I pretty much what I expected is he wants more time to assess things. And the real tragedy here is it's not the questions. It's the questions General Petraeus cannot and should not answer that are the most important. For example, although I want to hear from him about military security and whether it's achieved its goal of political accommodation, which it has not. Sitting beside him, we should have the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who should have answered the question, what's the impact upon our overall military security now that the United States Army does not have any unit here in America that can meet any timeline for any war plan, an entire annex of war plans? And what's the impact upon America's military security when we've been doing almost exclusive training in counterinsurgency to the negligence of everything else?
And then next to him should have been General Hayden answering for the CIA. What's the impact upon the global war of terror and our security when al-Qaeda has a safe haven now in Pakistan and the poorest border areas of Afghanistan? So in short, it's interesting and nice to hear from General Petraeus that he should be a supporting player on what the overall impact is on America's national security of his strategy. And if it's negative, we should then change the strategy, and that type of debate is not occurring.
In other words, we're focusing entirely on the micro. We should be looking at the macro. We're looking at the small picture of what's happening in Iraq, and we have Petraeus on because he's in charge of what's happening in Iraq, when we should be looking at the larger picture of how this affects overall American security, America's interests all around the world, and America's ability to fight any war anywhere for that matter.
Without a question. Not to have considered this was the failure of the first Petraeus report, and both Congress and this president have set it up for a second failure. Look, allowing one military man who's responsible for one portion of America's military security and set the tone for the whole of U.S. national security, not only, in my opinion, stands against the spirit of the Constitution, it also imperils the security of all America.
Well, then,
a comprehensive assessment, and that's what's demanded.
Then this begs the question, since the Democrats are in charge of Congress and the Democrats, hold the committee chairs that are calling witnesses, aren't you criticizing the leadership of, I guess it was the Senate this morning that the generals testified before?
Yeah, I've spoken about this since and brought it up, months ago, et cetera. However, I've been told by the leadership that they tried to get some individuals to come forward and the administration refused. Be that as it may, it should have been, in my opinion, a call to celebrate. Because we truly, truly in Congress probably aren't going to be able to end this war assuredly until we have a new president, but we should have been holding up a national mayor. And yes, I look at this as the Congress is responsible by the Constitution for providing for the common defense. And if nothing else, we should have held up a national mayor and made it an issue more than we have.
They always going to the bigger picture seems, an absolutely important and wise thing. I'm curious, sir, you're a superdelegate, what your thoughts are, if I may ask you, on the primary here. It's coming up in your state.
Yeah, it's going to be a great primary, and I think it's also making two wonderful, caring individuals who share deep beliefs about what's good about our nation and what we need to do to change it to become better presidential candidates. I endorsed Senator Clinton about a year ago because I did get to know her when I was in the White House and was quite taken by what she went about things. But as a superdelegate, I firmly believe that everyone, even if we go into a broken convention about this, has to understand it's not about one of these two individuals. It is not about party. It is about the nation. If we don't have a Democratic president at the end of this road, then shame on anyone who doesn't put their elbow, their shoulder behind whoever wins coming out of at least the convention.
Yeah, amen. Amen to that. And I agree with you. Either one of these people would make a great president. I think both of them have the potential to be the next Franklin Roosevelt, which is something we desperately need. We need to reinvigorate this country, bring our jobs back home, and get our nose out of places like Iraq, if I may.
Tom, you gave a great example. I just said this. I was on a local television here just a few hours ago, and I said, look, this is probably one of the more defining elections in a generation since Franklin Roosevelt. And keep in mind, Franklin Roosevelt, with Al Smith, went into a broken Democratic convention, came out of it, the party united, and look what happened. And we've got to do the same now.
Yeah, and Franklin Roosevelt was also, it was argued by many of the commentators and pundits of the time that, he's just a ne'er-do-well, he's just a rich guy, how's he going to help out America? And he was taking very conservative, very cautious positions in the election of 1932, and yet he got into office and he, in probably one of the most powerful ways, transformed this nation in the history of this country.
And that's why you can tell from these two individuals, hey, you can say what the relative strengths are, all right, but either one of them gets in there, I honestly believe they will quickly get to business. I happen to believe in the Senator Clinton just because I know she will on day one, but I'm convinced whoever's there is the right change.
Yep, from your lips to God's ears. Congressman Joe Sestak, representing the 7th District of Pennsylvania. Thank you, Congressman, for being with us.
Great to be aboard.
Thank you. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Things are going wild in the chat room. Sue had to step out. She was having problems with her mouse. I think she has to go clean her mouse's balls. Ball, excuse me. So you can drop by our live chat room by going to TomHartmann.com or TomHartmann.org. Either one, there's a link to our chat room over to the left-hand side. 35 minutes past the hour. Joe Sustak is so right. We really need to be looking at the macro instead of the micro. And, you know, the Democrats hold some responsibility for this as well. We all need to be looking at this. I want to just wrap up this thing about globalization that I started this hour with, and then we'll take your calls on you know, this and other topics that we've talked about today. Sarkozy talking about, hey, let's go back to tariffs, what he calls community preference. Berlusconi talking about, openly, let's go back to tariffs. India still maintaining tariffs on most things. China still maintaining tariffs on most things. South Korea still has a tariff-based trade system. Japan has a tariff-based system. And then Gideon Rockman also noting in today's Financial Times, he said, the sense that the poor have lost out as a result of globalization has grown with the rise in world food prices, hunger, that most traditional threat to ruling elites. Now, keep in mind, this is the elites talking to the elites. That's the Financial Times. Hunger, that most traditional threat to ruling elites, is returning to many countries that have embraced globalization. Political leaders around the world are struggling to contain all these pressures and maintain the consensus that has made globalization possible. But their task is getting harder. Globalization was made possible by political change, but what politics made, politics can take away. Amen! And it's time to take it away. It's time for us to have trade policies that make some sense. It's time for us, the United States, to say, well, gee, why don't we just have a trade policy that's sort of like South Korea's, for example. Japan's. I mean, Toyota. The olive tree and the Lexus, right? Tom Friedman's book, The Olive Tree and the Lexus, in which he is blithering about the wonders of international free trade, which only benefits huge transnational corporations. And he tries to make it like somehow the Lexus came about as a result of global free trade. It didn't. Toyota was a loom company. It was called the Toyota, T-O-Y-O-D-A, loom company. They made machines that wove cloth. And they decided in the late 1950s, early 1960s, that they wanted to go into the car business. So the government, MITI, the Ministry of Industry and Technology, this government agency, set up a huge subsidy program for them. Japan put into place import tariffs to prevent American car manufacturers from selling cars in Japan to compete against Toyota. The government subsidized their research and development. It assisted them with marketing and selling the product. Toyota became the Lexus. The Lexus came about 100% largely as a consequence of direct, positive, proactive involvement of the government of Japan in helping build an industry. And then you get crazies like Tom Friedman running around saying, oh, gee, look at this. We just need to do away with all these government protections and government programs and tariffs and things like that that might protect domestic industries and ship all our jobs to China, no problem whatsoever. And the proof of it is the Lexus. What? Anyway, I think I've made my point. Dawn in Detroit. Hey, Dawn, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Just wondering if you've been watching that special they've had on HBO on, you know, on John Adams.
I have seen two segments of it, but perhaps more importantly, I read the book by I want to say McAuliffe. That's not his name.
Well, I don't know how many segments there are, but I've seen five. I seen the fifth one on Sunday, and. I was just wondering your take on how accurate it was. It seems very accurate to me, and I think that they're just doing a wonderful job. The actors and whoever, you know, whoever directed this is just absolutely fabulous.
Yeah, I would recommend that you read Fawn Brody's biography of Jefferson, which is called Thomas Jefferson, An Intimate Biography. Fawn Brody has, I believe, since died, and the book is out of print, but you can pick it up in any used bookstore. It was published in the 1970s. And It's, in my opinion, the best biography of Jefferson that's ever been written. Jefferson and Madison, through much of their political lives, were bitter enemies and hated each other. And when McAuliffe, I think, isn't it John McAuliffe who wrote this book, or McCullough, the author of the book on which this series is based, when he wrote that book, we were living in Vermont at the time. This was maybe 7-8 years ago. And I remember two things when I read the book, two things that that really jumped out at me. Number one was he completely minimized what I think was the most significant issue in John Adams' presidency, which was the passage of the Alien and Sedition Acts and his hyping the XYZ affair. The XYZ affair was where he had sent over to France three people. One of them was George Marshall, who he later appointed to be Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Three people to negotiate with the government of France, with Napoleon. And somebody came in the middle of the night and said, hey, listen, we can get you an inside track for your negotiations if you pay us X. I think it was $10,000, whatever it was. And these three people never identified themselves, so John Adams referred to them as Mr. X, Mr. Y, and Mr. Z. Mm-hmm. And he used this as a way of whipping up war hysteria with France and making France the big terrorist enemy that we had to prepare for war to go against. At the same time, he virtually single-handedly pushed through Congress legislation, the Alien and Sedition Acts, which passed Congress by one vote. And Congress specifically wrote it so that it expired on March 1st or March 4th of 1800, which was the day that he would have left office if he wasn't reelected in the election of 1800. And he wasn't. Jefferson beat him in large part because of the XYZ affair and the Alien and Sedition Acts. And these acts gave John Adams so much power that he immediately, even before he signed it, Jefferson left town the day that Adams signed this thing. He literally left town in protest. He was the vice president at the time.
Right,
and he said, no, I will have nothing to do with this. And Adams, even before he signed it, took Benjamin Franklin Bach, who was Ben Franklin's grandson, who was publishing a newspaper in Massachusetts called The Aurora, and put him in prison because he wrote an op-ed, an editorial, in which he said that Adams had a bad temperament and was old, toothless, querulous, and balding. And for that, John Adams put him in prison. John Adams shut down the 20 largest of the Republican newspapers. These were what today is the Democratic Party, Thomas Jefferson's party. Shut down those newspapers, put their publishers in jail. Matthew Lyon stood up on the floor of the House of Representatives and challenged John Adams, and also challenged Roger Griswold, who was Adams' compatriot. He was the congressman from Connecticut. And he said that Adams and Griswold were serving the interests of the rich in the United States at the expense of the poor and the average working person. Griswold came over with a fire poker to pick a fight with Matthew Lyon. Adams had Lyon arrested, exported him up to Vermont, threw him into jail in Vergennes, Vermont, where he sat for 2 years in an unheated jail cell. He ran for re-election in the election of 1800, the election that Adams lost, and Matthew Lyon from Vermont won re-election from a jail cell because John Adams had thrown him into jail using the Alien and Sedition Acts. There was a guy named Luther Baldwin who was sitting in a pub, and all of this, I mean, you'll find this in any history except the history that this series is based on. There was a guy named Luther Baldwin who was sitting in a pub in Delaware. John Adams, actually it was mostly his wife, had standing orders that whenever their carriage came through town, the local militia had to come out. They had to fire their guns in the air and say, you know, long live and God bless John Adams. And so the cannons were out, and this guy is in this pub in, as I recall, maybe it was Trenton, New Jersey. In any case, Luther Baldwin is in this bar, and the bar is owned by a Federalist, a guy who is a partisan for Adams' party, right? In other words, back then it was the Federalists and the Republicans. Today we call the Federalists Republicans, and we call the Republicans Democrats. As the procession goes, and Baldwin was the local town drunk. He was an alcoholic. As the procession goes through, John and Abigail Adams, they go down the street in their carriage. The cannons go off, you know, for the salute, as was required by law by John Adams. And Luther Baldwin says to the bartender, "Ah, there go the cannons. They're firing them at John Adams. I don't care if they fire one at his arse." And for this, the bartender turned him in, and John Adams had him imprisoned under the Alien and Sedition Acts for speaking ill of the president. Luther Baldwin spent the next 2 years in prison as a consequence of having said to a bartender that he didn't care if they were firing the cannons at the president or not. That was John Adams. Now, the guy who wrote this book, no, this is all, you can, I'm telling you, you can read this in any of the other histories. McCullough, who wrote this book, when the book came out, had a picture on his website 6 years ago of him and George Herbert Walker Bush arm in arm. In my opinion, this book and this series is an attempt to sanitize and revive the wonders of a president who almost destroyed democracy in the United States and whose son became president.
Well, you're gonna love segment five, because that's the one where they all turn their backs on him, especially in the Senate, because at the time he's vice president, and they turn their backs on him because he wants to address George Washington, who was president at the time, as Your Highness or something.
Right, yeah. And no, then, John Adams was in fact, there are a lot of people.
Didn't go wrong. He started out, he seemed to start out as a fair person.
Adams and Jefferson, both of them, are very complex people. I mean, they both had parts of them that you know, in retrospect, were brilliant, and they both had parts of them that, in retrospect, were terrible. And to hold either one up as an absolute hero, I think, is a terrible mistake. Although, you know, the thing that really concerned me about McCullough's book is he spent the last third of the book trashing Thomas Jefferson. Anyhow, 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. The true people's radio.
Tom Hartman.
Because you're mine, I walk the line. I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds. Because you're mine, I walk the line.
You know, I feel that way about this country. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. By the way, the Tom Hartman Program, powered in part by the Teamsters Union. Speaking from behind the good old working-class stainless steel microphone, the Teamsters Union holding Waste Management Incorporated accountable for the fight for worker safety. Find out more at teamster.org. And welcome back. 866-303-2270, our telephone number, tomhartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room. Sue, I see Sue is back in the chat room. Apparently she got her mouse's ball cleaned up, and all is well. And now Higgins is going, mice? No, wrong kind of mouse. Janelle in Seattle. Hey, Janelle, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I hear you talking about trade, and the focus is always on economic impact.
Yes.
And I think
that there's also political and social and environmental. I mean, there's a whole variety.
Environmental was the point I really wanted to bring up. I mean, a good example, I live in Washington and trying to order salmon from Alaska recently. And a lot of the salmon was actually being shipped to China for packaging and then shipped back to Washington. And thinking about the oil and the pollution, and this is just common these days.
Yeah. Yeah, you're absolutely right, and so much of our food is coming from South America. Frankly, we really need country of origin labeling on our food, you know, as well as everything else. That way, at least consumers could participate in sort of the equivalent of a tariff. But Janelle, excellent point. Thank you for making it. And I would say, and let me just, since we were, I went off on John Adams in the last segment. And John Adams, and somebody in the chat room actually made a brilliant point. John Adams was a brilliant revolutionary and a lousy politician. And Jefferson, I think, was a brilliant revolutionary. He wasn't actually that much of a revolutionary. He was a brilliant and eloquent writer. He was so painfully shy. And this is where, at least in the two segments that I've seen of the Adams documentary, I know that, as I said, the last third of McCullough's book, he basically just trashes Jefferson. And using, you know, the perspective of Adams to do so. Jefferson was so painfully shy. And in fact, there is a book called by Norm Legend called Diagnosing Jefferson that suggests that he actually had Asperger's syndrome, that he was an Aspie. But he was so painfully shy and so basically socially dysfunctional that when he became president and had to give, you know, the one of the few jobs that the president has is to give an annual, it's not a State of the Union address. The Constitution doesn't require it to be a speech, but to deliver to Congress a something that tells what the State of the Union is. He was so shy, he couldn't do it. And so he wrote it, and he asked his friend and his protege, James Madison, to read it for him to Congress. But he comes across in the miniseries not as a guy who is shy, but instead as a guy who's some kind of arrogant jerk. And I didn't know either of the guys. I'm not that old, but I don't think that history holds that up. But my point, to take it back to Adams and Jefferson, in response to Janelle's thing about exporting pollution, is that people rightly criticized Jefferson for being one of the Virginians who was a slaveholder, as was Madison, as was Washington, as were most of the Virginians. It's a legitimate criticism. Even though he spent much of his life working to end slavery, the first piece of legislation he submitted as a member of the House of Burgesses in Virginia, as a legislator in Virginia, was to end slavery in Virginia. I could give you the whole list, but in any case, nonetheless, he was a slaveholder, and he's correctly criticized for that. However, Jefferson had to look his slaves in the face. I'm sitting here wearing a shirt that was made in Malaysia. I'm working on a computer that was made in China. Odds are you're listening to me on a radio that was made in some country like that, or over a computer, or whatever it may be. The jeans I'm wearing, I know we're not made in the United States because they're Levi's, and Levi doesn't make jeans in the United States anymore. I do have a pair of union-made jeans. There's one union shop in the United States, unionmadeithink.org is the website. You can find it. You can track them down. But at the moment, you know, what I'm wearing are a pair of Levi's, and I know that they're made outside the United States in some sweatshop someplace probably. I don't know. But the point is that we did not end slavery in the United States. We merely exported it. And we did not end dirty, polluting industries in the United States. We merely we put them in somebody else's backyard, the backyard of our new slaves. And until we come to grips with that reality, and that global free trade is a euphemism for exporting slavery, exporting pollution, and exporting poverty to a large extent, Mexico has not... The middle class of Mexico has not expanded as a consequence of NAFTA. It has shrunk. There are more people in poverty in Mexico now post-NAFTA than pre, for example. Then we're not going to get it right. Jeff in Tacoma. Hey, Jeff. Got about a minute here before we got to wrap up this show.
Excellent, Tom. You're speaking my language. Free trade is a total myth. It's a total fraud. And I just want to give props to Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama yesterday for saying the truth, that Colombia has participated in the execution of trade unionists. Bully for them. I'm so proud that they have the courage to say that. We should not have a free trade deal with them. But here's something I'd like Barack Obama to bring up when he talks to Petraeus today in the Foreign Affairs Committee, which is that Bremer outlawed labor unions in Iraq. And
that's right.
Then Negroponte rolled in, and death squads are killing trade unionists.
Yep, and in fact, when Negroponte went to Iraq, I pointed out on the air, I said, you know, when this guy went down to El Salvador, within weeks, you had death squads operating and people showing up with a bullet in the back of the head with their hands tied behind their back. Watch for it to happen. And 2 weeks later, it started happening in Iraq. Not that there's necessarily anything to do with John Negroponte. Could just be a coincidence. Coming up tomorrow, Sidney Blumenthal, distinguished journalist and former senior advisor to Bill Clinton as president, is going to talk to us about the strange death of Republican America. Plus, I'll be challenging former Undersecretary of Defense for George Bush Sr. about Petraeus. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it! Get out there, get active. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.